Dann let's start. When I was flying here, there was actually a nice lady sitting beside me, and she was from a Christian university somewhere in the Los Angeles area, and she has given me a book. And in this book were, of course, all sorts of circumstances that would indicate the existence of God. And well, I mean, it was already to modern cosmology. So, of course, the type of fine tunings that the creator had to use involved many quantities, in particular, of course, the cosmological constant. So, at this moment, I thought, well, accident or explanation. When it's an accident, it's not so far, you know, from creationists. So let's try to do our best to give nevertheless an explanation for this number of 10 to the minus 120 that we all want to find. I also thought at this occasion, this book was actually not so old, because if it had been written 10 years ago or 15 years ago, they would probably still have figured as one of the completely unexplained numbers that the creator had to foresee the present curvature of the universe. As omega is very close to one, we all know that in Friedmann cosmology this needs again a tuning of 120 orders of magnitude. Now, this number we have explained. Inflation is a beautiful explanation. Question is, what about other numbers? And I will try today to give you my view on the cosmological constant. I think the start can be very short. There are many evidences that the universe.
Now, what happened to the
These are just my collaborators. I should have spent more time on this slide, but I forgot to put it on. No, the talk I gave, my little introduction, was foreseen that you can read all my collaborators, but I forgot to put that on. Okay, so we now think we have about 3/4 of the universe made out of homogeneous dark energy, 25% of clumping matter, and observations are well compatible with a cosmological constant. Cosmological constant compatible with all symmetries, with all observations. No time variation in the contribution of dark energy has been observed, and the only questions are why is it so small and why it is important today. And both questions I want to address today. Mass scales, just to recall you, gravitational scale is 10 to the 18 GeV, reduced Planck mass, present energy density of the universe is 10 to the power minus 3 electron volt to the fourth power. And if you now compute the homogeneous energy density in units of the Planck mass, this gives you a number of the order 10 to the power minus 121, very close to a similar number for the matter density in the universe. Now, for the matter density in the universe, we can, of course, explain this number. This number is simply due to the fact that the matter density in units of the Planck mass is not a constant. It decreases with the second power of time. If you wait long enough, it's a very small number. And the age of the universe in units of the Planck time is really large. It's 10 to the 60. You square it, you get 10 to the power minus 120. So this number is explained. And of course, the first simple idea is, instead of a cosmological constant that has just to be prepared very early in cosmology and sits there and waits until today it's of the same order of magnitude as matter, you could have a dark energy component that decreases also with time, also with a second power of time. And then, of course, there is no big mystery. You just use the same central mechanism to get the 10 to the power minus 120 as it is operating for matter. You realize in this plot, nevertheless, that there is some little recent overtaking. So in earlier times, dark energy was at most 10%. Today it's 70%. This overtaking has been in very recent cosmology. And one of the aims of this talk will be to explain this overtaking.
What's wrong with this, imagining this a cosmological constant?
It's not wrong, it's just an unexplained number. You can say it's pure accident, anthropic principle, or whatsoever.
How about the quintessence, the thing that you said? Is it also an unexplained number?
This will be my task. So you judge how well I do, how far I go. This will be the questions: why is dark energy so small, and why it is important today? The basic idea, if you want to use a time dependence of dark energy, is of course that you use a field, something that can depend on time, necessarily can depend on space. No need in principle that this field is fundamental, could be some effective field standing actually for higher curvature terms or whatsoever, but it has to be a field, and the most natural thing is definitely a scalar field. I called it the cosmon at the time, and at least one merit of this approach is that it has really predicted a non-zero dark energy, a non-zero homogeneous component of the universe, even though the predictions at the time were certainly not 70%, but more, I would have guessed 10%. Of course. This will be the central topic of this talk. This will be exactly what I will address.
But this is equally ad hoc as...
Wait. Give me a little time to... Give me a little time. Give me a little time. I will tell you why it is not ad hoc. Okay. Okay, but before going to that, just let me recall you the basic little thing. I mean, when you have a scalar field, you get a contribution of the potential of the scalar field and of the derivative term, the kinetic term. They both contribute to the Hubble parameter. And if this part here is dependent on time but not on space, this will be, of course, a homogeneous contribution. The big question is, what is this potential V? And I will use here an exponential potential, and I will motivate this exponential potential. This will be actually my main task. So there are three things I have to defend. First of all, why an exponential potential? Second, the most hardest of the problem, why does that go to zero when phi goes to infinity and not to a constant? This is David's question. Obviously, if you add a constant at late time, you will find a cosmological constant, and you have again to fine-tune this number. So the task is explain why that goes to zero. And then it's not yet good enough, because you still have to explain this overtaking, this stop of the cosmon evolution, and I will tell you that there can be a cosmological trigger that actually makes cosmology of such models natural without and gives really an explanation of this why now problem. M is M Planck, reduced Planck mass 10 to 18 GeV. Sure. No, well, comes. I'll give you some simple examples. So this is a big task that I have today. So let me start with the second one and come in the second half of my talk to the first one. The second one simply assumes that you have this type of exponential potential. And still, it's by far not obvious why you can explain this why now problem, why... it's an effective potential. It's always, you integrate out all quantum fluctuations, and this is what remains you. You may also have many scalar fields. This will be a valley in the space of scalar fields that has this power.
This phi is a
gauge singlet. It will actually be the role of the pseudo-Goldstein boson of dilatation symmetry, which also explains why it has such a flat potential. And it also explains why, as very often in dilatation symmetric theories, if asymptotically fixed points are approached, then dilatation symmetry is restored, and then you get really a vanishing derivative of the potential. But all that brings me to the second part of this talk. So be a bit patient and allow me for at least another 20 or 25 minutes, just without questioning this exponential. Wait, now I'm not responding anymore, huh? Because otherwise we will not have come to the talk.
You will discuss it.
Of course I will, definitely. But let me organize the, the sequence of my arguments and not try to do it at random, even so I like responding to questions. Okay, so first of all, if you give me this exponential potential, then of course it's simple, solve the field equations, a coupled field equations. You find that the field really decreases to zero. And interesting enough, this exponential potential has attractor solutions that have really the property that the potential decreases exactly proportional to power, to the second power, to the inverse second power of t. Phi increases logarithmically, and the fraction in dark energy, which means dark energy density divided by the critical energy density, goes to a constant. So after some early wiggling, you have a certain fraction, let's say 5% of quintessence in these types of models as a stable asymptotic solution. You can compute this omega h depends on this dimensionless parameter alpha in the potential in a well-defined way. So far, so good. But if that is true, and if we have in early times only 10% of dark energy at most, by many observations, we would also say we have at most 10%, but we observe 75%, and we have to explain in such models why the fraction in dark energy increases in recent time. A realistic quintessence cosmology would rather look like that. So dark energy at some early time settles to the scaling solution, then for a long, long time it remains at a couple of percent, and then it quits the scaling solution. There's a crossover. Now today it shoots to 70%. Matter decays to 30%. It's a bit similar as this crossover from radiation domination to matter domination, and we will see that indeed it may have similar features. As a consequence, the equation of state of dark energy changes in time, as it is for most realistic models actually. So now, why does this crossover? This recent time here, why does that happen now? Now means a redshift of a few. I will give you a simple model that this can be produced by a cosmological trigger event, namely by neutrinos becoming non-relativistic. Neutrinos have a very small mass. We know the mass range of neutrinos, upper bound, lower bound. And neutrinos have indeed become non-relativistic only very recently. So that's in principle a perfect trigger, a perfect cosmological event that happens at the present epoch, and that can influence the evolution of the scalar field. And I will show you really a simple scenario where the mass of the neutrinos grows, and as soon as they become non-relativistic, they kick out the scalar field of the scaling solution, and then you have a crossover to a scalar field dominated universe. Crucial ingredient is of course that neutrinos couple to this Cosmon field. If they otherwise, the little fraction of neutrinos would be completely insignificant, but the important ingredient is neutrinos can couple to the Cosmon field. And then you...
Neutrinos couple the electrons.
Exactly. I will also come to that. Sure. These are obvious questions. Not bad questions. These are obvious good questions. But phenomenologically, neutrinos can be large. And what I want to point out is that if the neutrino mass is growing, it can really have dramatic effect by changing the evolution of the scalar field. So let me go to this growing neutrino mass scenario in a little bit more detail. First of all, just take it that if you have a particle with a mass that is growing, you will always have an end of the usual matter-dominated area and a transition to a new area, simply because the matter with a growing mass is diluted less fast than normal matter. This is very similar to the explanation why matter has finally to dominate over radiation, because it's diluted less fast than radiation. Now, if you have growing mass particles, they are diluted less fast than constant mass particles, the usual dark energy, dark matter particles. So therefore, they have to take over, and they have, of course, they can only take over once the mass plays a role, once they become non-relativistic. So you know there will be an end of a matter-dominated era, and actually, it's not as simple that just the neutrinos will dominate. It's more complicated. Neutrinos stop the scalar field, and then the scalar field will dominate. But the upshot of it is that you explain by that the energy density in dark energy not by some ground state properties. You explain them by some cosmological trigger event, by some very definite time, namely when the neutrinos become non-relativistic. And as a result, you get nice relations. You get really an expression of the energy density in dark energy today. I take it 2^1/4. Remember, this should be 2 × 10⁻³ electron volt. You get an expression where this depends on the present neutrino mass in electron volt. So if neutrinos would be GeV or something like that, all that would not work. And here you have a dimensionless coupling, to which I will come in the next transparency, which enters only very weakly, actually, in this relation. And this works. Wait a moment, come next transparency.
Do you assume universality among the three neutrinos?
I assume here, just for simplicity, equal masses, you can do it. It's the average mass, if you want, of the three neutrinos.
If this cosmion can couple to neutrino, why can't it couple to me?
One moment. So that's the first thing you get from this coupling. The second, you can compute the equation of state, and you get a number, -1 plus neutrino mass in 12 electron volt. And this is actually very close to -1. No? Unfortunately, this makes detection in certain respects not so easy, because the difference from a cosmological constant is not so easy. So now, first to David's question, what is this gamma? This gamma is essentially the ratio of the neutrino coupling to the cosmon beta over this parameter alpha that was appearing. So take beta something like 50. That the parameter alpha was the parameter in the potential. The potential went like V to the power exponent minus alpha phi over m. So that was one of the parameters of the model. The second is the effective neutrino-cosmon coupling. And you need a large coupling, not a tremendously large coupling. Beta equals 50 means that the force between neutrinos mediated by the cosmon chain exchange is 50 times larger than the gravitational force. So if you want the effective mass parameter that would appear there, that usually suppresses gravity, is a little bit smaller. So it's not tremendous, it's still gravitational strength, but it's a little bit stronger than gravitational strength.
The effective M is slightly smaller than your 10^18.
If you want. So it's not, but of course we have to explain it, and that will be the next thing. Why do does the Grossmann couple to neutrinos, not to normal atoms. Huh? It can, of course, couple to normal atoms, but much weaker. A typical coupling to normal atoms is, let's say, a factor 10 to the 5 smaller than gravitational strength that we know from equivalence principle and time-varying coupling. So you need a coupling of the neutrinos to the Grossmann that is larger than gravitational strength, whereas the coupling to atoms is several orders of magnitude smaller than gravitational strength. Well, the basic ingredient for neutrinos is that they get the mass from a different mechanism, whereas quarks, electrons, and so on get their mass just from the Higgs doublet, and therefore we know that the Higgs doublet can change very little as phi changes, otherwise we would get big couplings of the atoms to this Grossmann field. The neutrino masses are suppressed, they are squared in the doublet expectation value, but they involve also a heavy mass scale, typically gauge SU3 cross SU2 cross U1 singlet operator, either the right-handed neutrino mass, that's a seesaw mechanism, or a triplet mass of some heavy triplet, that's the mechanism I call cascade mechanism. And actually, if either that one or that one depends on phi, you will of course get neutrino mass that depends on phi, even though atoms, quarks, and so on depend, their mass depends very little on phi. Let me, to be specific, choose the mechanism where the triplet mass depends on phi. You could easily do it in a similar way for the thing for the right-handed neutrino mass for the seesaw mechanism. So, just to recall you very quickly how that cascade mechanism works. You have a triplet mass with a mass that will depend on phi, but you have also cubic coupling involving the triplet and the doublet square that's allowed by symmetry, and that tells you that your triplet expectation value is d squared over mt squared with this cubic coupling that is also of a large grand unified size. But this tells you immediately that the triplet expectation value is very small compared to the doublet expectation value, and this is of course an explanation why the neutrino masses are so small. This is pretty old stuff. It goes cascade mechanism goes nowadays actually mainly under the name of seesaw 2. So now let's assume that this triplet depends on phi, and now I will assume only a relatively weak dependence on phi. I write it here exponentially because that is how it appears in most models. If you would just take it, some linear dependence would not really change. What is perhaps interesting, this epsilon is now just something like 5%, so you have now again a coupling that is weaker than gravitational. Well, if the triplet depends on phi, we have the neutrino mass depends on phi, but now we have an interesting observation, namely that if the triplet mass depends on phi, it will change very slowly. The question is, what is the sign? If the sign is here negative, at some moment this will come close to zero. And when it comes close to zero, then of course the neutrino mass suddenly increases. And that can be a relatively strong effect, even though you have only couplings that are even weaker than gravitational. So whenever it's the zero is of course easily computed here, and whenever it is somewhere in the vicinity of zero, you have a neutrino mass that increases relatively steeply with time, and now you can of course compute the coupling between the Grossmann and the neutrino. That's simply given by the logarithmic derivative of the neutrino mass with respect to phi, and that is also increasing as phi goes to phi t, and so if that comes close, let's say within 5% to phi t, you typically find a coupling that is 20. So this is the explanation in principle why the neutrino coupling is indeed stronger than the coupling to normal atoms.
But that's your choice. It's not to be a single. You can do whatever you like.
There are, I mean, we are pretty happy if we can find some reasonable explanation of the why now problem. Well, maybe there are other better explanations to come, that I don't know, but at least it's one that is, I think, pretty reasonable. Triplets and doublets with respect to the SU2 weak symmetry. Well, the doublet is just a normal Higgs doublet. And in principle, if you have some, let's say, higher dimensional theory, you will get fields of all sorts. Most of them will be very, very massive. Among them is typically, for example, a triplet. If you have, for example, an SO10 unification, they will have triplet fields. But they are typically massive, but this does not mean that they have no expectation value. They get a small expectation value since there is a linear term in these fields as soon as the triplet, as the doublet gets a non-zero expectation value.
Huh?
Yes, or there are the fields, and then you compute the expectation values.
You also have a prediction that all neutrinos should have the same mass, except for...
Yeah, but that is not essential. You can just drop it.
We'll just work as well
if you have different couplings. Okay. Now, if I just take that and compute cosmology for it, this is now, of course, relatively straightforward. So cosmology has a simple two-stage feature. In early cosmology, the neutrinos are still relativistic. They play no role. You can essentially take it just a small quantitative corrections. And then the scaling solution applies. So the scalar field finds very quickly this tracking solution, and then scales the dark energy density scales with a second power in T, and you get this type of constant fraction in dark energy. But now, as soon as the neutrinos get non-relativistic, they actually change the evolution of the cosmon field, because you get, due to the cosmon-neutrino coupling, you get an additional term. You have not only the derivative of the potential here that drives phi to bigger values, you have now the term from the coupling to neutrinos that tries to stop phi, and it will stop phi very efficiently if beta goes sufficiently large. Notice that this term is of course proportional to the trace of the energy momentum tensor, so during the time when neutrinos are relativistic, this term simply vanishes and the cosmon is not influenced by the neutrinos. But as soon as the neutrino pressure gets smaller than 1/3 rho, then this term suddenly starts to play an important role. And if you now compute what it makes, it really stops the evolution of the cosmon field, or almost stops it, drives it down to very slow evolution whenever the neutrinos become non-relativistic. And this, of course, always has to happen. It has to happen in a period close to now. And also beta gets large in this type of approach. And this is why you can compute really the effective cosmological constant. It is essentially the value that the scalar potential has reached at the time when the scalar field is stopped by the neutrinos getting non-relativistic, and this event... If the triplet mass would really go to zero, this never happens actually in this case, but that would be of course in the far future, and at some moment when the triplet mass gets as small as the doublet mass, then we get a different symmetry breaking pattern, because then the neutrinos have the same mass as the quarks and there's a strong influence between triplet and doublet. But here, you know, it doesn't change tremendously. It changes, let's say, from 10 to the 15 GeV to 10 to the 13 GeV, something like that. That is enough. It's not something that, it gets really to the 10 to the 2 GeV region or something like that.
Eventually,
yes. If you wait long enough, well, it's very, very slow, as you will see in a moment. You really have to go, protons are decayed and all that before we reach that time. Okay. So, this happens recently, and this sets the scale, and this is why you get these nice relations. Here I also have given you now the relation for the present energy, for the present dark energy fraction, that should be 3/4. Again, terms of the neutrino masses in electron volt. If we have now this coupling, which is gravitational strength, so this only 5% or something like that, but then you have the factor that accounts for the increase in the neutrino mass from its, let's say, generic value, which would be more in a grand unified theory like 10 to the power minus 4, 10 to the power minus 5 electron volt, to the electron volt range where it is now. So it's essentially the same, it just gives an explanation what this beta is here. So I consider that as a pretty successful relation, actually. It's by far not obvious that you get this 10 to the power minus 3 electron volt ratio really out of it. Just to end with this part, the Cosmon evolution, of course, if you do it now numerically, you really see the logarithmic increase during the scaling solution, and then it settles to, it approaches a value regime where it changes only very slowly. The Hubble parameter, unfortunately, is very difficult to distinguish from a cosmological constant. I have taken here both, simply because the equation of state gets so close to minus one. If you compute the Hubble parameter a little bit more in detail and you divide it by the value for a cosmological constant model with the same dark energy fraction, you see, unfortunately, the effect is only 2%. That's not where you can detect it, or at least you need really not only the next project, but probably even one generation further in order to have a resolution like that. You can ask, can the neutrino mass change be detected? That's actually possible, because we have strong upper bounds on the neutrino mass in a lambda CDM model, simply because two massive neutrinos in early cosmology would completely change the evolution of structure. So you cannot have, let's say, half an electron volt neutrino mass in early cosmology. If Katrin or Gerda finds half an electron volt neutrino mass, it's a pretty good indication that neutrinos may have changed in time. That's actually a real picture in some village in Karlsruhe where they brought the Katrin detector in. So that's a possibility to detect it. Also, you may detect neutrino fluctuations. It's an interesting observation that actually, due to the fact that the Cosmon-mediated force for the neutrinos is stronger than the gravitational force, once they get non-relativistic, they start clumping, and they actually form clumps on supercluster scales, and we are just presently investigating if that can be observed. That would be, of course, very interesting. And the last thing that can be observed is, of course, the influence of early dark energy, to which I may come at the end. So let me conclude this first part. I think this model at least demonstrates that there are possible cosmological trigger events that can explain the Weinau problem. I'm not saying that nobody can find a better one, but this just uses the particles that we have and nothing really dramatic. And then, of course, one.
Phi is not. I'm not seeing phi fields here.
Phi field comes. For the moment, you. I mean, if you don't give me the phi field, there is not much to say.
That's the challenge.
That's the challenge of the second part. So, but at least if you have this exponential potential, then the Cosmon changes its evolution once the neutrinos become non-relativistic. This explains the Weinau problem. This has a new principle that singles out the order of magnitude of dark energy, because it's now a cosmological trigger. It's not built in the properties of the potential, and the model definitely can be distinguished from a cosmological constant. To that I will come later. So now let me come back to my two key features. This one we have dealt with. Now remains this one. Why do we get an exponential potential, and why does it go to zero when phi goes to zero? Well, this is the problem. Why does the cosmological constant go to zero? Of course, it's not a constant anymore. For that problem, let me. Yes? Well, because their mass is in the electron volt region. And so if you just compute when a given particle gets non-relativistic, you have to compare, of course, with a typical temperature or let's say with the typical energy scales in the expansion of the universe, and then you see that neutrinos have been relativistic for a long time, and let's say at redshift 5 in this type of models they have become non-relativistic. It's just the mass compared to the expansion rate. So.
Have you substituted the cosmological constant problem with why the neutrino masses are one electron bulk?
Yeah, but the neutrino masses, we have observed them in a certain range. Of course, it is linked. What I have done is I have linked the order of magnitude of dark, the presently observed dark energy, to the neutrino mass. If neutrino mass would be very different, I would get also a different order of magnitude for dark energy. But neutrino masses, we have measured them. I mean, you can also ask the same question for the transition from from radiation domination to matter domination. Also, matter must have the right mass. Dark matter must have the right mass and abundancy, otherwise we will not get this transition. Here we have the additional advantage that neutrinos, the mass is really measurable and the abundance is calculable. The abundance is known and it's just a question of time until the mass is really measured. Okay, so now let's go to this harder problem. And for that, I want to step a little bit back and ask, when we say that dark energy changes in time, what do we really measure? We actually measure not the potential, but we measure the ratio of the potential energy divided by the force power of the Planck mass. This is important to keep in mind. Whatever we measure, always dimensionless ratios. And of course, a simple possible alternative to potential going to zero, to potential going down, is the Planck mass going up. And this is what I will now study with you. What happens if the Planck mass is also a scale dependent field,
and
it goes up compared to whatever momentum scale you change. We can discuss then that not compared to lambda QCD. So this is actually on this. For the moment, let me. This is a relatively hard issue, because that if you would have an exact dilatation symmetry, this would be actually a statement that is not well defined. And only once you have a dilatation anomaly, you can really define a scale.
We don't have a world.
Yeah. I will give you an example where you can say to what. With respect to what it goes, but for the moment, we can just do it.
As you just explained, it means nothing.
Well, yeah. But if it grows faster than the cosmological constant, when it grows faster than the cosmological constant, then it has a meaning. Or for example, if you take a cosmological constant in some. Then it has, for example, a meaning. If you would have, for example, a cosmological. Well, but I have not get rid of it. So, for example, you can imagine that you have a theory of the with a cosmological constant where the Planck mass grows with respect to that, and then at the end the ratio will go to zero. That's perhaps the simplest way of imagining these type of theories. No, it's not order of minute. I mean, the only thing observable is our ratios. David is completely right. If all scaled in the same way, there is nothing to be observed. Everything is constant. But if you have, for example, a cosmological constant in a theory, but the Planck mass changes, then the ratio changes and the ratio will go to zero. And that is observable. And this is actually would be a type of theory of this type. We have still important constraints, because the Planck mass may depend on the field and the field may change. But better also, the proton mass lambda QCD, the W mass, are at least approximately proportional to this field. Because otherwise, the ratio between Planck mass and proton mass would change too strongly, and that would be a big problem. I will actually tell you a little later that I can easily solve the cosmological constant problem, but I have more problems to solve the problem that why the proton mass divided by the Planck mass, why that remains approximately a constant. This will be the really remaining challenge at the end. But this is required by phenomenology, otherwise we would observe strongly time-dependent constants. So imagine that all the standard model, particle physics, mass scale, move roughly at the same pace as the Planck scale in dependence on some field chi. And this field chi, this will be then the one that plays the role of the cosmon. As an example, consider chi as the typical scale where some effective higher dimensional description becomes a four-dimensional description, for example, in old Kaluza-Klein models, this would be something like the scale of compactification, typical geometrical scale of internal space. And typically, of course, in such models, the four-dimensional Planck mass will indeed depend on a field. So let's just write down such a theory. You have now, instead of the Planck mass, you have a field-dependent function, and I normalize the field such that it's just chi squared. This makes it easy, because then you can remember the value of chi is just the value of the Planck mass at a given time. Then you have a kinetic term, you have a potential term, and now, for example, if you want to describe the electron mass, this should, of course, also be in a linear in a leading approximation. Just be linear in chi such that the electron mass over Planck mass does not change. In a realistic theory, chi has, of course, no gauge interactions. It is an effective scalar field after integrating out all the other possible scalar fields in this theory. There's an interesting limit, namely the limit of an exact dilatation symmetry, which is not realized in nature, but is still an interesting limit. And we will see why. An interesting limit is that the potential is lambda times chi to the 4, and if lambda is a constant, we have exact dilatation symmetry realized. Also, if the other functions are constants, of course, we will expect dilatation anomalies. So these dimensionless constants are typically then running constants depending on chi.
This looks a bit like Brown-Stickey theory.
It is a bit like Brown-Stickey theory, except this important thing that all the particle masses also are proportional to chi. This is what ruins Brown-Stickey theory very easily, because you get a strong coupling of the Brown-Stickey field to particle masses, to the normal particles after Weyl scaling. Here, this will not be present.
Well, I mean, but another problem with Brown-Stickey is if you look at sort of energy loss in something like the binary pulsar.
Yeah. I know. You are right. Just let me tell you, this is fine, and we will see in a very short moment why it is fine. It is fine to the extent that this coupling here is really approximately a constant. The problems will only come when this depends too strongly on chi as well.
If psi is my electron sequence, yeah, then that is not constant.
Well,
because it is not a gradient of the junction.
Okay, then you replace.
The electron gets a mass from the Higgs.
Fine. Then you say, okay, I write here h times the doublet, and you arrange that the doublet is also proportional to chi.
But that will have explicit chi dependence there.
No. You have then in your, for example, in a dilatation symmetric,
Your statement, if psi is your absolute gauge thing, that has nothing to do with my electron, proton.
Doesn't matter. Because you also need, of course, the Fermi scale to be proportional to chi. So the doublet must be proportional to chi, which is not more difficult than having, let's say, lambda QCD proportional to chi, because in the limit of dilatation symmetry, all mass scales will, of course, be proportional to chi. We don't have it, and this will play an important role. We will then later come to the question, what is if these couplings depend on chi, and this will be, of course, a crucial point. You can have it, it's actually irrelevant, as I will show you in a moment. But let's just do that. Let's just say, okay, Now, let me phrase it differently to make it more clear for you. So now the most important coupling for our purpose is, of course, is coupling lambda, how that depends on chi. And I will assume that this coupling goes with some power a, with some minus a, goes to zero when chi increases. What does that mean? That is not a very such a tremendous assumption. It simply means that the potential for large chi increases less fast than chi to the 4. So if you have, for example, chi square, that is perfectly fine. Or if it, we would just have no potential, just a cosmological constant in this theory, then A would be minus 4, perfectly fine. The only thing I need is that this field, this potential, increases less fast than chi to the 4. This seems a priori a relatively harmless assumption. It's of course not, and we will have to come to that. But that is enough.
M here is a particle scale mass or a Planck?
M is the Planck mass, which is again this chi-dependent Planck mass.
How does V over the weak scale to the fourth go?
How does
V over the weak scale to the fourth? How does that depend on chi?
How the weak scale is also proportional to chi.
The weak scale is also proportional to chi.
All scales are proportional to chi.
So the same statement holds then for V over the weak scale to the fourth.
Yes, and you better would have, if you have then this type of dependence here, you would have a very small anomalous dimension or even a fixed point. That's another interesting issue because, of course, many of the dimensionless couplings, as chi increases, could go to fixed points, and then we would be in business. Whereas here, lambda, if it goes to zero, it would, of course, also go to a fixed point, but to a fixed point that it is at zero. And this is a particular thing that is important for the explanation. So, but for the moment, just first follow first the argument, if the potential, whatever it is, increases less fast than chi to the 4, let's say chi to the 3.8 or chi squared or whatever you want, then you are in business. That's enough for a solution of the problem. We will come back if that is reasonable. Why is that enough? Well, because the cosmology of such a theory is a bit particular, because your potential, normally you are used that your scalar field goes towards the minimum of the potential. This is not what happens. Due to the coupling to the curvature scalar, the field actually runs up the potential in the cosmological evolution. So it really probes the region of large chi. Now, this is what cosmology does. It goes away from the minimum, it goes to the large chi. This is why the mass term and the constant term and also on are all not important. It's just the behavior for large chi that matters. Now, if it runs to large chi, we have already seen that the ratio between potential and force power of the Planck mass, this decreases to zero. And this means, of course, that the effective as cosmological constant will asymptotically vanish for a large time.
Sorry, what kind of numbering are you assuming between chi and r?
V over m to the fourth. Let me go back. This is my theory. I assume that this potential here grows less fast than chi to the 4. Let's say chi cube. Then I compute potential divided by the second power of the Planck mass. You get another 1 over chi to the 4. So this ratio is actually just given by this lambda. And if lambda goes to 0, then the ratio goes to 0. This is, of course, a key element. That this ratio goes to zero. Once you have that.
Sorry, do you have then a negative curvature potential?
Chi is just growing. Just imagine this chi cube for large chi, something like, or chi, let's say, not to have, you do not want to have it, of course, going to minus infinity. Chi squared or chi absolute magnitude to some power. This is what is called an anomalous dimension, actually, if it increases not exactly like chi to the 4 as it would be in a dilatation symmetric theory, but with some other power. I will come a little bit later to that in the language of dilatation of renormalization group equations and dilatation symmetry. But for the moment, this is not so bad, because you can now, we have now understood, yeah?
This is the long sine wave.
That's not the wrong side.
Well, as you know, there's a bound scale
of
field.
No, I will give.
It says you're almost making that bigger than one.
Wait. Of course, I did a lot of these renormalization group studies. You should imagine that not in a four-dimensional theory, and I will come to that in a moment. You should embed all that typically in a higher dimensional theory and consider really this as an effective four-dimensional degree of freedom. And I will show you, I will probably argue with you in a little. Okay. Well, we have understood if it runs up this potential and if it gets less fast than chi to the 4, then the effective cosmological constant will go to 0. That is easily to see and much more familiar to you when you do a Weyl scaling. Weyl scaling simply means that you change the metric by a chi-dependent function. You also change your scalar field in a notation that is perhaps more familiar to you yet. And if you do that, Weyl scaling, you find that in the Einstein frame, you have of course now a constant Planck mass, but now you have an effective potential for phi. This phi is indeed an exponential potential.
So we know there is from the Higgs a mass of order, an energy of order m weak to the fourth, and I guess that's m weak to the fourth chi to the fourth. Mm-hmm. Can you really write down a potential that has the Higgs and your chi?
Mm-hmm.
It has this enormous term in it.
Yeah, for example, just take the mass term in the scale of the for the Higgs doublet to be proportional to chi squared.
Right, it has to be. And that's your sort of.
Okay.
Right, so then there's an energy m weak to the fourth chi to the fourth. Why doesn't that dominate?
Okay, this will be the question of quantum fluctuations, to which I actually plan to come if you will let me a little bit more time. But let's first.
Same thing would happen to electrons.
No, of course, the old question is, would quantum fluctuation not give me just chi to the 4? And then I'm dead again, because chi to the 4 will not work. I need an increase that is less fast than chi to the 4. But nevertheless, if I have it, then I get really an exponential potential, first of all. And second, it goes really to 0. There is now an explanation why there is no constant, because we have understood why the ratio goes to 0 in the Jordan frame, and of course it has to go in all frames to 0, and this explains why it is really going to 0. So, let me give you a simple example where to realize that. That is not yet realistic, but let's consider all the setting in higher dimensions. And my upshot will be that it's actually not difficult at all to get a situation where you get an exponential potential that decreases to 0. It is difficult to get the time-varying fundamental constants right. It is difficult to get a fixed point in the evolution of the other couplings. And this is, of course, what is also definitely required. Typically, you have different sorts of runaway solutions. I will give you only the simplest here, the geometrical runaway, because it's easiest to explain. There are others which I will not cover. All this runaway solution, that means that some scalar field in this higher dimensional theory does not settle at some fixed value, but continues to evolve in cosmology even now. Kaluza, Klein, string, what you want. This is for the moment still relatively general. Let me give a simple, very simple example, but it demonstrates the effect well. Let's just take one of the earliest model that goes back really ages, six-dimensional gravity with a gauge field. Because there we know the solutions, you can explicitly construct them, and you can explicitly find cosmological solutions. The metric is typically one that is a four-dimensional metric, you have here. A phi-dependent factor, I've already used notations, which brings me close to what I will come to at the end. Then you have an internal U1 symmetry, and typically if this B is different from 1, it will be a space with conical singularities. So nowadays one would say you have brains sitting at these singularities. This is not my main point, so let me not come to that too much in detail. But I can show you that with this metric, that this is an exact solution of the higher dimensional Einstein-Maxwell equations for a monopole solution in the gauge field, provided that this prefactor phi obeys these equations. And here you recognize, of course, immediately the cosmological equations for a Cosmon field, and you can compute in this theory the associated potential. It is indeed an exponential potential, so for large phi it's just this term. In this case, phi is just this prefactor in this metric here. You can associate that actually in a certain sense to the typical length scale of internal space. I will do that in a moment. This is internal space is two-dimensional, so it has these coordinates rho and theta. Theta are just on orbits. You have U1 symmetry. It's a sphere where B is equals to 1, and it's a football-shaped geometry with two brains sitting on both ends if B is different from 1. Also, it's not something very dramatic. It's something that has been investigated in many simple examples. But it has an exact cosmological solution, as I just have shown you, that has exactly these properties. And of course, if you now look at this, you find that there is actually no constant. Phi is in a certain sense.
Phi goes to infinity, corresponds to what?
Volume going to infinity, and that will create a problem for the time-dependent constants. But still, it's a
simple.
Yeah, not really, because you know the other scales. The internal space never reaches the four-dimensional ones, but it grows. Internal space grows. This is the simplest example of a geometrical runaway where you just have no stable solution for the length scale of internal space, but it just continues to grow. It's clear that this will create problems for the dimensionless constants like alpha. We will come to that, but at least
phi over
the Planck mass is growing. Yes,
size and
is growing. Yes.
No.
Well, you have the cosmological constant. Oh, well, you have the potential for phi that really acts like a cosmological constant. I mean, you can compute the cosmology of it. And the Planck, yeah, the mass scale had several parameters of the order of the Planck scale.
Einstein, Maxwell.
Yeah, oh, you have here a higher dimensional Planck mass, you have a higher dimensional cosmological constant in this case, and these fields also have, of course, dimension mass, so the gauge coupling that is there has also dimension mass. Yeah, there are also those. I want to go to the particular ones where the internal space is not going to a constant, but where you have this type of geometrical runaway. And I want just to convince you that this is a very straightforward solution. The asymptotics is, of course, exactly of what we had. In this case, of course, omega h goes to 1 because there's only a scalar field. We would have to add matter. It would, again, to go to one of these scaling solutions. But this nice, simple observation is, in this case, there is absolutely no tuning of parameters. You always have these cosmologies where the effective cosmological constant goes to 0 asymptotically. Simply, I mean, it's not a difficult fact. This I told you already. We can understand that geometrically in a very simple way. The potential goes with the power of internal length to the power d. The Planck mass after dimensional reduction goes with the power L to the D. If you take the ratio V over M Planck to the 4, this goes to power L to the minus D, and that of course goes to 0 when R goes. Very simple realization. The problem, as I told you already, what to do with the time-varying fundamental constants.
Are you claiming to have solved the quantum problem now?
Huh?
Are you claiming to have solved the quantum problem?
Or in this case, there is no quantum problem, yes.
This is what everybody else calls self-tuning. This is not an original idea. And it's, I mean, and it's wrong because there's a solution you want, and there's also solutions in which there's, in fact, a cosmological problem.
Let me finish my sentence. Yeah.
And so the tuning comes into the initial conditions. You have to suppose the initial conditions were tuned so that today we would have the solution that has small cosmological constants. But what you, I mean, when you want the synergy with these football shaped conventions, this is self-tuning. This is an idea that has been around, and then we know why it's wrong.
Well, no, Joe. This six-dimensional Einstein-Maxwell equation has other solutions. And for these other solutions, it's true that the cosmological constant appears as a free integration constant, but there are also solutions, neighboring solutions, where the four-dimensional cosmological constant is different from zero. I actually studied this model in 84, 85, something like that. But this is only one class of solution. Here it's a different class of solutions, namely, if you want this potential. This potential has a bit of form like that. It goes to 0 and then there is some additional minimum. So the tuning solutions you are referring to, they correspond to this minimum. And here, actually, it is true that you find a solution with zero cosmological constant, but you find neighboring solutions with non-zero one. Here, it always goes to zero, simply because internal space grows. There's absolutely no tuning on this side.
But you've in one transparency leaped over the central issue, which is why is the cosmological constant over the weak scale 10 to the minus 50th, since they both have the same time dependence?
Or here, and this is very simple. That's it. Here it's trivial. You know, if you're on that side, internal radius just runs away to infinity. So it's just trivial scaling argument. Just do this little exercise. It goes to zero.
It would be nice if this gap between the two previous slides had been made your whole talk, because that's where the key issue is.
Well, I can't do much better. Once you have a solution, yeah, internal radius continues growing. Just by dimensional reduction, it is very straightforward. The potential will be L to the power d. In this case, d would be 2. The Planck mass would also be proportional to L squared. Just from the integral over internal space.
So your dimensions are huge?
Yeah, they're in 6 dimensions.
So you are, but so today we're 6 dimensions.
Yes. Okay. We are not really approaching 6. No, it's more complicated. It's more complicated than that. We are approaching an infinite radius of six-dimensional space, but we are approaching an even bigger radius of of our four-dimensional world. Let's come straight to the real problem. The problem is, if you have that, and if you would count in a Kaluza-Klein calculation, for example, the gauge coupling, this gauge coupling would also go to zero. And so would be all other couplings. They would not go to fixed points, but to zero values. So in that sense, it's a solution of the cosmological constant in quotation marks, but it's not a good one. It's not a good one because the price to pay is too high. But it just tells you that you can easily have these geometrical runaway solutions and also other types of runaway solutions where the cosmological constant actually goes naturally to zero. This is my point. This is not the main problem.
Six-dimensional cosmological constant, that doesn't go to zero.
No, that is non-zero. No problem.
So what the hell are you solving here then?
Well, I've constructed you. No, come on. Come on, let's. I've constructed you a cosmology that has an effective four-dimensional description. The dimensional reduction is perfectly valid. It has decay with t to the power minus 1. The Hubble parameter is t to the power minus 1. And the energy density goes to 0 with the second power of time. This is constructed. You do not have a realistic particle physics. Well, of course there is gravity. Let me just tell you, when I do Weyl scaling after that, you just get this type of theory that we had before with a constant Planck mass and this phi going to 0. And the only thing that happens and that is bad is that also the gauge couplings go to 0. This is the only problem. Otherwise, the theory has no problem.
For the same reason that they are called gauge couplings. Same reason that if you were putting external masses between
I still have, of course, my gauge fields, for example. If I do this dimensional reduction a la Kaluza-Klein, I would have, of course, gauge fields, a billion gauge fields. The only bad thing is that they would not couple to the electrons of this theory anymore. You can have even electrons, you can have chiral fermions on these spaces, so you would get a lot of massless particles. The only bad thing is they would decouple from each other. This is the problem. Otherwise, it's a perfectly nice cosmology.
The couplings about the mass. So does your four-dimensional effect of Lagrangian include the term of order the weak scale to the fourth?
Oh, this has no weak scale in this case. What you would get in this case, you would just get massless chiral fermions with massless abelian gauge fields. But here, in this case, you would, of course, the masses would just be...
The real world,
it's the couplings that are a problem, and of course also all mass ratios, for example, electron mass to Planck mass, that should go to 0. This is not solved here. So this is the unsolved part here, is that we have to solve the problem of fundamental couplings, and this is a very severe coupling problem, because if you compute in these models what is the typical order of magnitude of change of the dimensionless ratio, the relative change is order 1 at redshift 1. And now if you look at experiment, go back to nuclear synthesis, where we have by now, since we have a very good determination of the baryon density by WMAP, we can compute with the computed abundances, which work well for helium and deuterium, for lithium not so well, but you could now just for fun construct some grand unified theory that matches all of them and compute what would be the variation of alpha, and you typically find variations of alpha of the 10 to the power minus 4 level. So, and this is redshift 10 to the 11, so obviously this variation must be very small, and one has to find a mechanism how to stabilize these couplings. I will only, since time is running out, unless somebody gives me much more time or more time, I will only make two comments. There are two ways to solve the problem. You could, for example, follow the path that the volume or the curvature for internal space of internal space are actually irrelevant for the standard model particle physics. Namely, if the standard model particle physics are concentrated near a brain, and if all particle physics properties are given by brain properties, then you could, another one is typical stabilization by fixed points that I will not cover in any case. Let me just come very quickly to these warped brains. There you could really have the idea that you have very different characteristic length scales. So this is for gravitational solutions by far not unusual. We know from black hole solutions, black hole, for example, embedded in an expanding cosmology, we have the Schwarzschild radius of the black hole, orders of magnitude different from the curvature of the universe. So if you could realize such a scenario, where all masses and couplings of the standard model particles would be determined by the singular behavior near a brain, and therefore a typical mass scale of the brain would enter, then you could easily have the solution that the rest of internal space, or in particular, what really matters is a generalized curvature invariant, which is relevant for the potential. Right, I just have to make now a decision how to organize things, because this is obviously an interesting point, and shall I switch to that? Shall we just...
I think that's the point that we keep coming back to.
Okay, then let's just finish this talk with the last 5 minutes on this issue of quantum fluctuations. I think I have convinced you by now that in principle, if you have this type of runaway solutions, things may work. And now we have to ask the question. Do we know from quantum fluctuations that this cannot work? Because this is obviously what you are thinking. Actually, this is of course also my worry since almost 20 years, I would say. So this is the obvious question. Now let's discuss quantum fluctuations. And for that, we have to learn a little bit more about the role of dilatation symmetry and dilatation anomalies. Because they are either as a fundamental symmetry or as an effective theory in the effective four-dimensional world, they are a crucial symmetry in order to understand what happens with quantum fluctuations. Because if we go back to a dilatation symmetric formulation, the question is now, how does this running of lambda, which is in our case, it has to be given by an anomalous dimension, how is that affected by quantum fluctuations? Whenever you have an equation, an anomalous equation of this type, you're in business. The question is, first of all, is there a fixed point for lambda equals to zero? And then, of course, if the deviation from a fixed point of this beta function, if that is given by an anomalous dimension and not by lambda squared. Actually, lambda squared is very particular to four dimension, so this is not really the crucial issue. You generically get, if you embed that in a higher dimensional theory, you get an anomalous dimension. The question is the fixed point behavior, if the fixed point is really at zero. But let's still come a little bit to this equation and just assume we wanted to compute this dilatation anomaly. We wanted to compute really this beta function. And what would we have to do? First of all, the question is, what are the dominant fluctuations? You usually think that the dominant fluctuations are something like that even the electrons fluctuations or the photon fluctuations, that they would mess up the problem. This is completely irrelevant. The only important fluctuations here, the by far dominant fluctuations, are actually the fluctuations where the momenta are of the order of the Planck mass. They are the ones that will determine the fixed point. They are the ones that will determine the anomalous dimension. And the contribution of, let's say, QCD fluctuations is suppressed by 80 orders of magnitude as compared to these Planck scale fluctuations. So you should really think, if you want to compute a beta function like that, your task is you have to do that in some unified theory, and you have to understand what happens, for example, at this transition between higher dimensions and four dimensions. So in a sense, it's the infrared physics of the higher dimensional theory seen as the ultraviolet physics of the effective four dimensional theory. So this is the first important ingredient. So if you just concentrate on some submodes like lambda QCD fluctuations, you concentrate only on a tiny bit that gives only a 10 to the power minus 80 factor.
However, a tiny bit that's enormous compared to the
balance. Well, but the question, I will come two more slides and then I'm done. Huh? The next step that is really important, you have to make up your mind in which frame you're computing. Because most of our intuition is actually given by computations in the Einstein frame with a fixed Planck constant. This is very inappropriate. This is very inappropriate because in this frame, the dilatation symmetry is not visible anymore. And the real reason why you get a flat potential is exactly dilatation symmetry. This cosmon is the Zullo-Goldstone boson of dilatation symmetry. This explains why you have a flat valley. Actually, this flat valley can be very complicated in field space. Well, you have typically many scalar fields, but dilatation symmetry, spontaneously broken dilatation symmetry, guarantees you that there is a valley. And if dilatation symmetry is not exact, then of course you get a non-vanishing gradient along this valley. Also remember something that you know from statistical physics, that whenever you have runaway solutions where fields change and your scale and you have a fixed point behavior somewhere in your theory, then at the fixed point, dilatation symmetry is always restored. This we have already observed here. Because whenever you go to time to infinity, to large values of the phi, we actually approach a fixed point. We approach a fixed point in lambda equals zero, and we would hopefully also approach fixed points for the other dimensional constants that are non-zero. But then you get a restoration of dilatation symmetry, and that corresponds, of course, exactly to the fact that the potential derivative goes to zero as phi goes to infinity. Now, this is nothing else than the well-known feature that when you approach a fixed point, dilatation symmetry gets restored. So after saying that, it should be clear that it's pretty chanceless if you try to understand this type of fixed point behavior in an Einstein frame simply because your symmetry is not manifest. And for quantum fluctuations, it matters. I mean, once you have included your quantum fluctuations, your ordinate Einstein frame are completely equivalent. But for your quantum fluctuations, there's a Jacobian, and this Jacobian is really very complicated. And if you do a simple assumption of your functional measure in one frame, we will get, and you use the same assumption in the other frame, you would get vastly different results. So recall that what we have to compute here is the behavior for large chi. So many of your intuitions in the Einstein frame are actually not relevant. After computing quantum fluctuations, you can do whatever frame you want. But in order to compute the quantum fluctuations, you have to fix your frame. Otherwise, you really get different results. I mean, this is actually well known by people who do quantum fluctuations, for example, for inflation. It's not such a new thing. This is something you have to do, and I'm just advocating strongly use the Jordan frame when you want to understand these things. The Einstein frame will be completely misleading. In particular, we should now discuss this question of individual contributions, because you know we say always we have lambda QCD, that gives us anyhow a contribution order lambda QCD to the force. This is something that can be very wrong. It can be very wrong. It is actually such a procedure very wrong in all statistical physics systems where you have a fixed point, because usually, if you have in presence of a fixed point, you get for many quantities highly predictive answers. For example, in this case,
it's wrong in statistical systems where you have a fixed point and you fine-tune your external relevant parameters to reach it.
Well, whatever system it is, there are actually systems also that where you have scaling without tuning parameters. Two-dimensional systems. But whatever you have, whenever you have a fixed point, and you would now say, okay, I compute the typical soil size of a certain coupling by just taking one component of my complicated system, you would get orders of magnitude wrong very often. Well, simply because fixed point properties are very contrived, and for the fixed points, properties, I mean, it's all the fluctuations together that determine the fixed point. Once you have a fixed point, no, not always. For example, Kosterlitz tau is a low energy phase, has scaling behavior without any tuning. Two-dimensional systems, there are plenty of them. One-dimensionals even more. Four-dimensionals, not so much. Four-dimensionals only in dynamical systems. Otherwise, I don't know of any. Also three-dimensional. But two-dimensionals, there are systems, of course, that have long-range behavior without any tuning. No, not really. The low temperature phase of the Kosterlitz-Paulus phase transition has a massless Goldstone field. Has a massless Goldstone field without any tuning of parameters. Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying. I know examples. I know a couple of examples in two and one dimensions. I don't know anyone in three. We do not know if here we will have a tuning. In order to have, this is of course now the question. The question is, if lambda has a fixed point to which it will finally release, will this fixed point be at zero or different from zero? That we cannot answer by pure arguments of dilatation symmetry. Definitely not, because a fixed point at lambda different from zero would still be consistent with dilatation symmetry. Nevertheless, whenever it has a fixed point, computing some quantities, the deviations of this fixed point, just by taking some quantity, some artificial isolated fluctuation, would always be very wrong. This is just a...
If it's attractive.
If the fixed point is attractive, yeah. Yeah, if the fixed point is attractive, this is of course what is assumed. This is the size of the sign of the anomalous dimension. If the anomalous dimension, it has to go with minus a, not with plus a.
The electron mass is irrelevant.
The electron mass, we would of course hope that. No. We would of course hope that the dimensionless coupling relevant for the electron mass. This should go also to a fixed point, to a non-zero fixed point. I'm not saying that I have solved this problem, otherwise I would stand here and say I have solved the cosmological constant problem. But this is the issue. You have to find a fixed point for lambda at zero and a fixed point for the other particle masses at non-zero. Finding a fixed point for lambda at zero is not difficult. I told you already, geometrical runaway is, for example, an easy solution. But the other one is a difficult problem. And
in some sense, the other ones feed into lambda. When you integrate out the electron, the mass feeds it. So.
Yeah, all the fluctuations are just, you know, at the end, you just want to know the beta function for lambda. If lambda has a fixed point at zero, and the right sign of the anomalous dimension, then you're in business. That's all you need. And that includes, of course, all quantum fluctuations. And actually, maybe I do that as a last remark, because I'm really over time now. There is something that is singling out fixed point lambda at a zero value from a non-zero value. And that is actually closely related to this geometrical runaway, where we've seen it already. The issue is stability. Simply because a beta function that would cross the value lambda equals to zero would lead us from a stable to an unstable theory. Because when lambda gets negative, your potential is bounded in the other way around. And that is usually not what happens with flow equations. No. It's in your, you know, think about your Einstein, your Jordan frame. Your potential would be really minus chi to the 4. So it really changes from plus chi to the 4 to minus chi to the 4. And that is why it will not go to, it will actually not cause this value. This is a very reasonable reason why you have the fixed point really at lambda equals 0. And we've seen it. I mean, I've given you this geometrical runaway where exactly, of course, it would go to 0 but never cross 0. So this is. I mean, this was a very explicit example. I mean, I've given you an example for this geometrical runaway where lambda was really going to zero. I can compute, of course, the anomalous dimension for this geometrical runaway. So this part of the problem has a solution in principle. It's the other part that is hard, and with that I want to finish and then we'll go to the discussion. It's the other part that is hard, have a fixed point for lambda equals to zero, combined with a fixed point for other dimensionless couplings that is not at zero. This is the hard part. Once you have that, the problem is solved. And this is the part that I have not yet solved. And I think at this point, I leave the floor open for the discussion. And I think there are still many interesting questions left.